The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Marcella, you write in the book that your life has taken a series of unexpected and improbable turns. I think people may be surprised to hear that you spent part of your childhood in Egypt.
In Egypt?
Yeah.
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Well, because my mother was born in Beirut, but after the family traveled to Egypt. And she came and she went to Italy because being Italian, she never saw Italy, so the mother and the father decided that she could have a trip to Italy to see Italy, to learn about. And there she met my father, and they married, and they stayed there for a year or two. I was born there. But after, she wanted very much to go back to Egypt, to her family, her friend, and my father was in the middle to open his business in some part, and he decided that, okay, instead of opening in one city near our town, it was much easier to go to Alessandria d'Egitto and open it there, so they traveled there. And we stayed there until I broke my arm. And you don't know that I broke just a bone, like it can happen very often, but they put me in a cast so tight, and they didn't want to take it out. So when they decided to do it, the arm was in gangrene, and I had to cut it here. And my mother didn't accept that. So she knew that a professor very well known in Bologna in Italy was there. So she took me there, and I started spending a few years in the hospital and near the hospital, and I had a lot of surgery and therapy and all the other things for a few years. Before I decided that at that point that I could not do anything, and so I got my arm that doesn't go down more than this, the hand is like this, and I had to cope with. So I did it.
And I think you said at that time your family moved to Cesena. I'm sorry.
Come on near. I can't hear you very much.
Okay.
Or I come here near one of the two.
Okay. And this was a resort town.
A fisherman town, too.
A fisherman town. And you say you were very lucky to spend your life there.
Can
you talk about that? What?
Well, at that time, being that was a beach resort town, there were many families that had a house there for the summer because it was a wonderful beach, a wonderful sea. And there were also boys and girls, more or less of my age. And we had this committee, company, group, let's say, that we didn't have any money. Also, the one who had it didn't bring up money, I think. But so we could have a wonderful time almost doing nothing, just to discuss what to do the next afternoon, and not decided, naturally, or to go for a trip in bicycle. But we didn't have a whole bicycle, so instead of having six bicycles for 12 people, we had only five, And the other one, who didn't have a bicycle, supposed to run on the tube of the bicycle around or in the manubrium. And we take a trip, naturally, the one who's not working in the bicycle, and that was after coming down with sore back and leg. But we like it. We laugh about those. We were taking trip just to go to eat a sandwich that we carry in the other next town.
This was unusual, having the sandwich, right? During the midday meal, you would have the sandwich on the beach.
Yes.
And which was kind of unusual at the time.
Yes, but, you know, we met in the beach. We swam. We did almost nothing, but we were happy of not doing nothing. We always talk about doing things without doing.
When the war started, I know your family packed up and moved north to Lake Garda. And I guess they thought they were getting away from the war, but it actually turned out to be in the middle, actually, right
the worst
where
part, the worst part
Mussolini formed his fascist republic. What was this like? You were in the middle of the bombing and your family. What was this like to be a young girl in Italy during the war?
It was a strange life because, you know, a teenager is the age that you have a lot of dream. You think when you grow up you wanted to do this, you met a prince or what else. The thing, all those nice things, but they were not what I could think during the war, because all what we were thinking is to be alive the next moment. Because they were bombarding all the time. It was a moment that you could not sleep in the night because they were bombarding. You could not be quiet during the day because they were bombarding. They were always bombarding. And knew that you didn't have a normal life. Can you imagine to eat when we were able to have food to bring at the table also, because that was very difficult, because the Germans, they were taking everything that was possible to eat and left the Italian without almost anything. And, you know, in the Lake of Garda, when we went, we had 3-4 miles from our house the head big German commander from Italy. So, they knew that they were there, so they were bombing all the time. And when Mussolini was before in prison and after the German freed him and brought it where? 2 miles from our house. And there he decided to make Italy a republic, the Republic of Salò. The Allies, they knew that he was there, so they were bombarding. So we had one part of the German, the other Mussolini. And we were always, can you imagine eating when we had food to eat? We could not sit in the table with the leg under the table. We were sitting sideways on the way where the door was to run to the shelter. Because sitting this way, you can get up and run right away. Mm. And after, when you could not have time to run to the shelter, because they're starting bombarding right away, you were catching your plate with the food, and you were going under the table, because you wanted to save the food from the plaster, that the shaking was coming to the food. Mm-hmm. That was not a normal life. But at that moment, everything of that type became normal, because every day, every minute was the same. Also, the valuable, all the things, they were different. Can you imagine to think to have salt that is valuable? Like, you ever think that a person became poor because doesn't have much salt?
You have a great story about your aunt
But there, salt was impossible to find it. And we were lucky because one of my aunt was living in Venice, and the husband was working for the electrical company, so he was not paying electricity. So he had this stove that was going on 24 hours a day with a big pot full of water that was taken from the lagoon. At that time was not polluted, and cook it down until you end up to have just the salt. And after, she was so nice that she gave us a little one, you know, 2 tablespoons, 3 tablespoons, and we could trade that to have some meat, something to eat that was not possible to find it because money didn't have any value. Jewelry, gold, nothing. You can't eat gold, mm-hmm. You know, and it was different.
I think this time also shaped some of your cooking. Your cookbook fans know that you love chili peppers, and this love of chili peppers actually came from the war because
peppercorn didn't exist. And if you had a little, you could save it. At least we did it. Because we were lucky to bought a little pig, you know, that we raised to have meat, seasoning and things like that. And for the cold cut of the meat, you need a peppercorn. So we kept it for that. But, you know, we could grow the red pepper. And use it.
And your love of olive oil from that region remains. Is that part of your memories from that time?
Yes.
Now, your main interest was studying science. I mean, you have 2 PhDs, but your career eventually became cooking. Are they related?
No. Not at all. I studied science because I like it, because I thought that was my life and was my career. And being in that the university, they were never near home. I was away from home, and I didn't have the cooking of the home, you know, only when I was in vacation. And I was not interested in food. I didn't care about food. For me to have just a sandwich, the cheaper one, it was enough. And if I had 1 lira more, I could spend it in another way, but not for food, because it was just eating because I had to eat, but not because I was thinking about eating. Until I met Victor. That is my husband now.
Let's talk about that. That's Victor was fascinated by food, and
well,
you said when you were
talk about food, and you know, he was telling me what he had for lunch, and what he was going to have for dinner, and he was courting me, but you know, it was a little strange to have this courting. Not very romantic if you talk always about food. But I was in love with him anyway. But it was strange for me, but okay, nothing. But after we married and he took me to America and I had to cook for him, that was a problem. Because I never cooked in my life. And I didn't know at all. I had boiling water only in the beaker, in the laboratory, but not in the kitchen. And I didn't know what to do. But naturally, one of the first things that Victor did was to take me to the supermarket so I could buy things without knowing one word of English, no? But the supermarket, I never saw supermarket before in my life. I found everything was dead there. Everything was wrapped in a coffin. So, you know, and I never saw a chicken so dead in my life. But, and it was difficult. I didn't know what to do with those things. I didn't know how to cook. I didn't know how to do it. I didn't know how to buy it. But you know what? It's strange because sometime you don't realize that passing by from a store who produce food or a door of a restaurant or at home in the kitchen, you smell something, you see what you are eating, you smell what you eat, you taste, and all this memory, they come to you in a little corner of your brain, they stay there, and you don't know that you have it. And after, I think you have it by osmosis, you know, you absorb those things. And after, at one point, they come out little by little, you know. And maybe if you are lucky, and I was lucky, that I could interpret those feelings and try to work with those in the kitchen. And also, I think that one big, big help was Victor, because when I cooked something that was good, he was jumping from the kitchen, come to kiss me to say how good I was, how brave I was, so I wanted to do more. And that is how I started to learn how to cook. But if one day would want person could tell me that I was get involved in food, teaching Italian cooking, or writing a book, I thought that they were crazy.
Now, at this time, I found this is really interesting. You became a big baseball fan, the 1955 Brooklyn Dodgers.
Well, as you know, when I arrived to America, Victor was leaving for job. We live at that time, not in Manhattan, but in Forest Hills. And Victor was leaving home early in the morning and come back late at night. And I was all alone. And I could not talk to anyone at all. And I didn't know also anyone. And I was there running from one room to another, not knowing what to do because I never took care of a home because I was always studying at university. And but it was another thing that it was very new for me was the television. I never had seen a television before, and that was the season of the championship of baseball. And Victor was telling me that at that time it was the Dodger, no?
Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah. And he said to me they were from Brooklyn, and Brooklyn was a part of New York that was Italian. So I said, okay, let's be fair about them. And Victor took a shoebox and designed the field and taught me about the game. So the first word in English that I learned was strike, ball, run, home run. And so those were all my English. And I was looking dead because I didn't know what to do.
Are you still a baseball fan?
Yes. But I'm mad and the Mets didn't do good now.
Living in Rome, you moved from New York back to Rome, and you say this is where you learned about cooking vegetables. You went to the market in Rome and talked to a lot of the vendors, and they would tell you how to cook the vegetables. Can you talk about that? I found that really interesting.
Well, you know, after 7 years that we were in America, we decided to go back to Italy. But in those 7 years, I had learned how to cook. I had found out that I liked to cook, and I became interested about the ingredient, about the way to cook things, and so on. So when we went to Italy, it was natural for me that I was where really the Italian cooking was, no? So I start to go more to the market, talk to the vendor, and go to the store, butcher and so on, restaurant, and ask them what they were doing, how they did one dish and another, because I was interested in that, but not because I was thinking that I was working with food. But, you know, I learned a lot in that way, and I like it.
I was moving back to New York, and it was actually a Chinese cooking class that you took, just one, that began your own cooking classes.
Well, you see, in the 7 years that we were the first time in America, I was working in the laboratory and doing research. I was doing research in the gum disease, pyorrhea. I was always in the mouth. After, when we came back to America, I didn't want to go back because the hours, they were terrible there. And I wanted to do something else. And one of the things, I found out that I was in love with Chinese cooking. That was new to me. So I wanted to take a course. But it happened that the teacher, Madame Chu, went sabbatical back to China, and some of the lady in the course, I think I didn't know what to do, and because one day one asked me, what you cook at home? Naturally, I answered, normal food. And she said, what is normal food? Italian. Okay, why don't you teach us to cook Italian? I thought that they were crazy. I said to Vettor when I came home, you know, look at this. They gave me telephone number and so on because they wanted me to teach cooking. And Vettor said, well, why not? He said, you like to cook, you like to teach, because I was teaching, not cooking in Italy, science. And I said, why don't you do it? So you start complaining that you don't know what to do. Okay. So I started doing. I was scared because I didn't know how to do it. But, you know, those ladies, they were very nice. And I start learning about the American, what they eat, what they don't want to eat. You have to see the faces when I took out the bowl to clean a bowl full of dirty squid. Everyone screamed, no one wanted to touch it. I didn't know what happened. There's squid there. Okay. I learned they didn't want to eat organ. But anyway, but I enjoy it very much. And I started that way.
And it was on October 15th, 1970. Your life changed again when you invited New York Times food editor Craig Claiborne to lunch. And you said, I have never since then had to be concerned about how to spend my time. Can you tell us about the lunch and what you served?
Well, you know, those six ladies, they took a course of six lessons, and after they took another, and after they took another. And this went on from beginning of October until June. In June, I told them, goodbye, I'm going to Italy to see my parents. So, and after, Vittor asked me, would you like to teach again? And they say, yes, but who? They said, those six ladies, I don't know anymore what to teach them. And I said to me, well, you know, the New York Times has a list of a cooking school. I will write to. Okay, so I'm right. He wrote, but we got the answer that unfortunately, when our letter arrived, the list of the cooking school was already out, and so I said, all right, that is the end of my new career. And I put my heart in peace. But after, I think, 1 or 2 weeks, someone called on the telephone. Now, you have to know, I'm sure that you know that If you know very little a foreign language, the telephone is a monster. You know, you don't understand anything. All right. I understood that that was from the New York Times. That want to come to talk to me about the cooking lesson. Wanted to come Wednesday. I said, all right. At what time? It's like 12:30. Okay, so I'm sorry. At 12:30 we have lunch. And I said, well, what about Thursday? Good. At what time? 12:30. But I said, every day we have lunch at 12:30. So if you really wanted to come at that hour, come for lunch. Was quiet a little, and I said, really, your husband come home for lunch every day? Yes, of course. Okay, I will come. Point. Waiter come home and ask, what is new? You have any call? Anything happen? I said, yes, yes, someone from the New York Times call. And I told them the story. And they said, but you don't have any idea? Who is it? They said, no, because, you know, I don't understand the English name and they're foreign and it's impossible. And they said, but you don't have any idea what? I said, I don't know, it's something like crack, crack. And he said, crack Claiborne. I said, that is. I think that is. He said, yes, do you know who is it? And you invite him for lunch. But I said, what do I have to do? He wanted to come at 12:30. It was the only way to do it. So he came and he wrote a beautiful article and the school went on.
How did you decide on the menu to serve that day?
I did an Italian menu. I did some antipasto, some pasta, some dish of veal, a vegetable, a salad, and a fruit. But he likes it because he did a really nice article.
You said you couldn't improve on that dish even today, or
no,
that
from
meal.
From that moment, I didn't have any problem to find students.
When your first cookbook, the Classic Italian Cookbook, was published in 1973, it was considered groundbreaking. What was Italian food like in America at that time?
Well, was what the American taught about Italian food that was not Italian. It was Italo-American food. They did dishes that you can travel all over Italy. Also now you never found it. Like manicotti doesn't exist in Italy. Chicken tetrazzini doesn't exist. And you can go all over Italy. You never have an espresso with a lemon peel. And you can buy any brand of canned tomato. You never find one with a basil in. And so on. And I think that there were the immigrants here that they taught or they were doing those things and for different reason, and they became thinking that people that they were Italian. And you know, also because big part of the immigrant, not all, but a big part, they were very poor, and so they emphasized the part of the food that was more expensive, like pasta was a big amount of sauce, because the sauce was the most expensive part of the dish. And so you end up that you are eating the sauce with the pasta, but not the pasta with the sauce. It became the pasta seasoning for the sauce. And other things like that. And but they changed a lot from when I started. Very much they changed it. Now also ingredient, you find that is possible. You find Parmigiano Reggiano in the supermarket. You can find artichokes or fennel in the supermarket before. You have to go to a specialized store to find it. And sometimes they overdo it, you know, like pasta. I found that before it was overcooked. And so when they found out al dente, Okay, but dente is one thing. Uncooked is another thing. And sometimes the pasta is uncooked, you know, it's not al dente. And so, I think I have hope.
You came to regret introducing Americans to balsamic vinegar, too.
You touch a sore spot. You know, if you buy the original, let's say, to make a small bottle of aceto balsamico, a real one, you need at least 60 years. And it's not commercial, you know, because it's too precious. And now, if you buy a small bottle like this, who has the cap in gold, or where the balsam vinegar is 25 years old, you spend $185 for a bottle like this. Now, think about the restaurant that you go and you ask, can I have olive oil and vinegar? They bring you a bottle of olive oil and a bottle like this of balsam vinegar. What they say is balsam. It's not balsam and vinegar. If you are lucky, it's a wine vinegar where they added caramel. And it's not possible that the restaurant give you a bottle like this or something that could cost, if it was really something like $400, and you have to use it a few drops. But it's not. So it became, and also, I don't know what happened. If you go to Italian restaurant now and you ask, they don't have any more the wine vinegar. They have only balsamic vinegar. And when this trip here, I have a chef that asked me that wanted to do a dish using balsamic vinegar. But come on, stop it. That is something. I can tell you one thing. I don't know if I wrote in the book or not, because, you know, I don't remember anymore what I wrote. But during the war, a family, a friend of mine, had a brother with his family to go to live with them because he was in the middle of a farm. So they thought that they could not have bombarding things. And the lady of the house was telling me that during the war, it was an air raid very bad. And everyone ran to the shelter, and they were worried about the brother that didn't arrive until he arrived late with a little barrel like this, balsamic vinegar like this. And they said, what happened to you? Well, I wanted to catch my balsam vinegar. This one of the persons said, they said, what? You didn't look for your wife? You didn't look for your children. You didn't look for your money, only for the balsam vinegar. And you know what he answered? Another wife, I'm young enough, I can have another one. Children, I can have more. I can work, I have more. But 60 years of my life to do another of this little of the balsam vinegar, I don't have it.
You and Victor collaborate on all your books. How do you do this? How does it work? And what's it like?
Well, it works. Sometimes very smooth. Sometimes not so smooth. Writing a book, a cookbook, it was different of this one. Because the difference was that I was writing a recipe or two or three that I was sure that they worked that way, gave it to Victor to translate. And in the time that he was translating those, I was in the kitchen to try other recipe. And one of the things that I'm not used, that is very hard for me to do, is to measure. But I have to do it because I have to put the amount of the ingredient. And I said, you know, did I put it, did I measure, or did I measure? Because it can. And Vittor was coming and said, Marcella, in this recipe, all the string beans that I eat in this house, they don't have both hands. What you do? Of course they take it out, but you didn't write. Okay, give me back the recipe. Back to him. Go back where I was in this. Did I measure the olive oil or didn't measure the olive oil? And after when they said what I had to do, he was coming back. You said boil the string beans, but in how much water 1 pound? I have to figure out. And after the pot was closed or open. And all this, you know, sometime, and you know, I said, once I remember that I got so mad and I said, if you come again, I'm divorcing. I can't take it. But I found out that he was right. And I think also that is the reason that my recipe usually works, because it's very precise. This book was different. Because you see, from when I was born, that I write about when I was born, and I remember the story that was telling my parent, my grandparent, until I met Victor. He was not there. So I was writing, and he had to accept it, because he was not there. But after 53 years we married now, and he was always there. So, you know, sometime it was the same. No, Marcella. Was not Dorothy that came to the restaurant when happened this story. It was Ellen. No, it was Ellen. Or was not that restaurant. Big discussion. And I have to say that usually he's right. I don't like it, but he's right.
Now, did you help with Victor's wine book? Was Marcella part of that?
No. Actually, my wine book helped Marcella a lot, because in researching it, we traveled all over Italy, every region of Italy, talking to virtually every significant winemaker, and all winemakers have somebody in the kitchen. And so Marcella would go, well, I was talking about wine, she would go in the kitchen, and she picked up an enormous number of recipes in the course of doing that.
Was in the cellar, I was in the kitchen.
But you've never included any wine pairings in Marcella's books.
No, I really have no admiration for this effort to pair wine with food, as I have always taught during our classes, because I taught wine during the classes. I demonstrated that you drink the wine that you enjoy with whatever food is being brought to the table. You know what wine you want to drink, and that's what you pour. For example, at some point in my life, I got fed up with white wine. I suddenly realized what a bore it was. And so we no longer had white wine in the house except in the kitchen, because Marcella cooks with it. And so when I was under contract to do a new wine book, it was going to be called The Color of Wine is Red. And the only thing is, at some point I gave up on it, because I was no longer in tune with the style of Italian wine that was being produced. I had become too international and too indifferent to the values of the territory. It may have been very good, but it wasn't necessarily Italian. It could have been Australian or Chilean, mm-hmm. or Californian. So I lost interest in it, and I didn't complete the book.
I think last time we spoke, you were about to do that. And I remember you suggested you would drink a Barolo with a can of tuna and beans. Because yeah. you just wanted to. I actually told someone at Moore Brothers that one time. Now, your students have included Danny Kaye and Burt Lancaster and James Beard. What were they like to have in class, and were they good students?
They were most serious, yes, very serious. When Danny Kaye signed up for the course, I was really a little afraid because, you know, Danny wanted just to have a joke and have an audience that laugh with him. And I didn't want that in my school because I wanted to teach and seriously. But he was very, very serious student, so much that also it helped me to have the student to be more attentive than usual, because if he saw someone talking and making noise, he was going and whistling the silence so much that after when he left, he gave me a whistle, said it's better that you use it, and I use it after. But I told him the book also a story that when he came once unexpected in one of my classes in New York, and I took a telephone call, and here's a telephone call because one of the students was taping the lesson, so I have the tape of his part of the telephone. And it was incredible. If you read the book, unfortunately, we tried to sound like my Italian accent, but it was much, much better. We succeed, and it was a very, very funny story, that. My student gave me possibility to write many funny things, because many funny things had happened in 37 years of teaching, you know. There were strange thing. I found out that many Americans don't like to see a fish with the head on. I had a broad in the kitchen, a beautiful fish, and I had a student that started crying and almost fainted. I said, what happened? She said, he's looking at me. He said, what do you mean he's looking? He's dead, I said. There's the thing. I learned a lot about the student, you know, but, other person that they came, they were very nice. We had a mixture of people. We had a lot of surgeon, medical doctor, and we had it from all over the world. We end up, we counted how many states they came, and they came all over, but not China, Russia. We had a lot of students from Australia, from South Africa, India. But they mix it together very nice, and they work.
Did you enjoy the classes?
Very strict. We didn't allow them to interrupt the class. I was stricter. I didn't want to have an interview during the class. I didn't allow television or radio during the class. After, yes, but not during. But they did that, and many things funny happened with the student. You will find in the book many more than this. But anyway, once the group was going, because they had the meal during the class, you know, but I taught, and after we ate what we cooked. But after the evening, I was taking the group to every night a different restaurant, with a different type of food, and I was explaining the food. And one time, they were going with Victor to a cellar to taste a certain type of wine, and after they're supposed to go to a a very small trattoria, you know, in the field there. And that I had found out today ahead that this group was drinking a lot. And they said that, you know, that the owner of the cellar is very generous, and these people will arrive at the restaurant all drunk. I have to do something, so I decided to give them something to eat during when they were drinking the wine. So, and I had a woman who was making, you know, that flat bread, the piadina that is from that region, with some prosciutto and some salami, so they could eat something. Okay. When the bus with the student arrived to the restaurant, I went there before to check if everything was all right. They remember what to cook or what not to cook and so on. One of them, the person that was helping me with this group of people, came to me and said, "Marcella, we have a problem." I said, "What is now?" It always was a problem. She said, "Well, you know, when everyone was in the bus, the lady that was making piadina called me. They said, look, I found on the table, this is not mine. And there must be one of yours." I said, "What is?" She said, "It's a denture." I said, "A denture?" "Yes, it's a denture." One take a course of cooking, she lost a denture. So I said at the restaurant, I said to my son, "You sit there, Victor there, me here, and the other person who's helping me, and watch who is not able to eat." Because you can go around and ask, "Did you lose a denture?" You know. It's not very nice. Okay. Everyone was eating. Okay, I don't know. Okay, so we arrived back to the hotel with the bus, and everyone was in the lobby, you know, talking, "Tomorrow morning I'm going to jog, or what you do with that." And at one point it was a voice, "Margarita, did you find the denture?" I don't know, maybe she had a spare one in the bar. Well, you find many, many things like that that happen on those years.
They're asking me to wrap this up, but I just want to ask this one last question. Your mother, who lived to be 101, never approved of your cooking career.
No.
Why was
she
that?
She never understood why her daughter with my father made so many sacrifices to send me twice to the university for 2 doctorate degrees. End up to be in the kitchen. Could not understand, accept that. When I was going to see them, you know, sometime I was translating her some article that were read to me. She was listening a little, and that's, "It's better that you write about your wife, life." Now, I cannot tell her, "Look, I did it." She's not here anymore.
But she would have been happy with the book. I think now we're going to be taking questions from the audience.
What happened?
What's this?
They ask questions.
Okay.
You have to help me because I don't understand what they ask.
Okay.
So far away.
Okay, thank you. Victor, you alluded to how much wine has changed in Italy, becoming more international style. I wondered if you could comment on the extent to which cooking in Italy has changed during your lifetimes, if it has, as the wine has changed, or if the traditions have been more constant, if that makes sense.
Well, cooking hasn't changed as much as the wine has, because you can still, well, aside from the families that are continuing to cook as they've cooked for the last several generations. There are still restaurants that basically cook the same menu, and it's not a fault. You know, we don't think this is a drawback. When we go to Venice, there are three or four restaurants that we go to, and we know that we were going to be able to eat the same thing that we ate last year and the 2 years before that and 10 years before that. Now, in America, this would be unthinkable because the chef has to change menu every week. But no, that doesn't happen in good restaurants in Italy. Of course, there are also the media-sensitive restaurants that want to get attention in the restaurant guides and newspapers, and so they come up with embroideries on the traditions of cooking. But in wine, it is a considerably different story because whole areas of extraordinary territory in Italy where native grapes could produce wines that you would find nowhere else in the world are now producing Cabernet, Syrahs, Merlots, combinations of these wines, which are perfectly good because, you know, Italians know how to make wine, and the territory is excellent. But they're wines that you could just as easily find in Australia or in South America or in California. They're not distinctively Italian in character, and that disappoints me when I see that.
Can you tell us the three restaurants that you like in Venice?
Well, you know, there's also this, you know, when we walk into a restaurant in Venice that we know and where we are known, we probably eat a little bit differently than you would eat if you went there. But some of the restaurants that we like very much in Venice, one is called Daivo, that's spelled I-V-O. Another is called Testiere, T-S-T-I-E-R-E, which means headboards. Bedboards. They're bedboards for the head, headboards for a bed, because they have two antique headboards hanging on the wall, and no more than, I think, seven or eight tables. There is also, it has now become very famous. We knew it when they just got started, Da Fiore. And there's a restaurant that people think is not Venetian. It's called Fiaschetteria Toscana, and because of the Toscana, they think this is Tuscan cooking. It's not. It's a very, very old Venetian restaurant, and we eat extremely well in all of those places.
Is there more questions? One over here.
Mrs. Hazan, I was wondering about your thoughts concerning the slow food movement that has run across the world.
Oh, slow food. Okay. You know, they're talking about using fresh ingredient, which is all right. I thought that was normal to say that. And another thing, I remember when they started in Italy, just a few persons there were, and Carlo Petrini, we knew him very well, he had this idea. I think, in one way, I think it's not bad because they try to keep the originality. Do you know what is the dishes, what's supposed to be, and what is supposed to be the ingredient today? We have to use it and save it, and that is good. But naturally, but I don't think much about it because I think of what they say. It was very normal for me to think, and it's not that I'm changing something.
Well, that is because we find that many of these organizations develop into sort of political movements. They have an agenda, and so the agenda becomes confused with the original principle. The original principle of slow food is extremely admirable, and I think they've done some very valuable work. But as it becomes more successful, like organic, for example, I think organic has become a political agenda. It doesn't really, let's put it another way. To Marcella and me, we think there's really only one important thing to judge food by. And we think that food is one of the most important things in our lives. Obviously, it's kept us together for 53 years, but there's only one thing, ultimately, that you must judge food by. Not by whether it's new, not by whether it's organic, not by whether it's made by some almost unfindable little artisan grower up in the hills somewhere, but how that dish that somebody has with care and understanding produced, how it tastes once you put it into your mouth.
What it tastes is the most important thing, because you have to eat it and you have to enjoy it. And it's that you go to a stream about baby vegetable, zucchini of this. They don't have any taste. They don't taste the zucchini. If you put it in your mouth, you don't know what you are eating. So, okay, I don't want the zucchini baked like that. But it's something in the middle that is good. Now about cooking also, do you know? Before, 37 years ago when I started more in this, when I was married, you know, we go to restaurant, the vegetables, they were overcooked, mushy and things. Now, they go in the hot water and they come out. They're not cooked because they have to be crispy, okay? They're crispy, but they don't taste anymore what's supposed to taste. When I was teaching, do you know, I remember that I was boiling some string beans, and the people was looking at me and they were uncomfortable. They said, Marcella, I think those string beans, they must be cooked. You know, it's a lot of them. Okay, they think they're cooked. So I took it out. They tasted. They were tasting, said that they are cooked, yes? Okay, but I'm going to cook it a little more. And I cook it a little more, and I said, now you taste it. Oh, now they taste more string bean. Before, what they were tasting? A little grass, okay? That is. You know, you go to a stream, like the pasta before was saying, al dente, and now they go to extreme to undercook completely. Why don't they have a good middle? But, you know, so the organic, do you know? Okay, they're good. But I'm not going far away if I have to have something that doesn't taste good. I want something fresh. I want something that has a wonderful taste that I need.
Maybe somebody else has another question.
Yeah.
Any more questions?
Hi. Could you tell me one of your favorite recipes, and could you describe how you make it?
This is one of those media questions again. You know, we get this question in different forms all the time. What is your favorite dish? If you had to have one meal, what would it be composed of? If you had to go to one restaurant back home, which one would you go to? And, you know, it's really unanswerable because Italy has an unlimited number of dishes. And we like variety. And someday we may like one thing, and we may not make that thing for another 10 days or 2 weeks. But I think if you rephrase that question, if you were to ask, what would be the category of food or category of dishes that it would hurt you the most to have to give up? Which would be the most difficult for you to give up? Then that is easy to answer. The most difficult category of dishes for us to give up would be pasta. I can't imagine a life without ever having a dish of pasta. It doesn't matter whether it's homemade or factory-made, whether it's sauce with tomatoes or white truffles or whatever. You know, I think there are moments when a beautiful, simple tomato sauce is fully the equivalent of the most expensive shaved truffles over a over homemade pasta. So that would be the number one category. Next category, and this, of course, is subjective for us, would be vegetables. It would be terrible to have to go through life without eating vegetables. And the category after that would be fish, seafood. Most meats, especially since we're now in our 80s, we have not too much difficulty giving up. You know. And perhaps a single ingredient, there is a single ingredient that I think is absolutely indispensable to life continuing, and that is chocolate.
I think we have time for one more question.
Thank you. Our country owes a great debt to Italy for improving our menus and what we eat. Is there anything that our country has contributed to Italy's cuisine in the same time?
But you mean contributed in terms of food or just generally?
Generally.
L'Italia ha fatto molto per l'America perché ci ha dato tante buone cose da mangiare. E l'America che cosa ha fatto per l'Italia? Ha fatto qualche cosa per l'Italia?
Well, yes, it did. First of all, the Italian like very much to copy America. Very. They like very much. They start to have supermarket, they have to have... the young people go to eat to McDonald's because now we have McDonald's. I don't know what it has really of good things. But, no, I'm not joking. It has to have. Has to have because I remember when I married, I came to this country, no? And I learned to be a wife and housewife in America. I learned how to cook in America. I learned how to make a bed in America. I did everything that I never did in Italy. When I went to Italy to live, I thought that many things they were normal and they were not anymore. You know, I found in a way that I was in a foreign country again. Because the many things, they were different. And I was thinking, which now I can't understand what was that I was thinking, that I would like to take this from America and this from Italy, put together, and have what I want of a nation. In America, they have a way of living that is... in one way, it's not so nice like the Italian. The Italian, they say, well, if I can do today, I can do it tomorrow. And maybe the next day after tomorrow also. And the American, they're not. They're more pushy. And I would like a little more nerve, you know, to this. But I think that... they have things that I like the freedom about not copy things, you know, because everyone does the same thing. Sometime in Italy that happened. But not many. I'm sorry. I would like more.
I just want to thank you. Thank you so much for being here. Please join us upstairs for the book signing in the lobby.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.